hello, friend in Amsterdam.
Hi, Katie. It's a big week for you.
I'm getting married this weekend, listeners. No biggie.
It's so exciting. How are you feeling?
I feel sort of scary, excited. Like that Dutch word of yours that you love using.
Oh yeah, spannend.
It's spannend.
A wedding is very spannend.
But as discussed, Dominic, this is just the legal wedding with like immediate family. And we are planning a party with all of our friends next year. And I am expecting you to sing that Portuguese Eurovision song from a few years ago that I love so much.
Great choice. Are you also going to go down the aisle with our jingle being played?
Oh, that would be so hideous. No offense to our amazing jingle writer, Jim, who will be coming to the pub bit of the wedding.
I think the sheep at the end of it would be perfectly placed for just as you arrive at the registrar.
It's got that sort of gravitas that you really want from a wedding.
It really does.
What have you been up to?
Oh, you know, nothing as exciting as planning a wedding. I've just been gardening and pondering whether we're in the middle of World War III.
Yay.
But so let's move on and talk about what we're going to be talking about this week, because there's another big event coming up other than your nuptials. It is our favourite time of the year. It's almost Eurovision Song Contest time.
Woohoo!
I know not everyone loves Eurovision, this annual cacophony of camp, but I hope our interview later on will be enjoyable even for the Eurovision skeptics out there. We're going to be having a discussion with Dr. Dean Vuletic, an academic who is the world's leading academic authority on the history of the Eurovision Song Contest. Isn't that the coolest academic job there's ever been? We will be diving into this history and, of course, also taking a bit of a peek at what to look forward to in this year's competition, which is about to kick off in Turin in just a few days. Can you believe it? That's coming up a bit later on in the show. But first, it's time for... Who has had a good week, Katie?
I'm going to tentatively say it's been a good week for putting pressure on Russia, because the European Commission has announced a plan for the EU to ban imports of Russian oil within the next 6 months as part of its sanctions over the war in Ukraine. It's a classic good week with plenty of caveats. You ready?
Go for it.
First things first, I wanted to talk about a misconception that I've had over the past few weeks. And I'm curious about whether you also had this misconception. What do you think Russia makes more money out of oil and gas?
Oh, I have no idea. And I always use them interchangeably without really knowing which one is which.
Not the same. But take a punt. Go on.
I would guess gas.
It's actually oil by a long, long way. In 2019, Russia made $123 billion from exporting oil compared to just $26 billion for gas. And I think people like you and me, who thought it was the other way around, that is coming from the fact that we've been talking a lot here in Europe in recent weeks about how reliant we are on Russian gas, specifically Germany, of course. And it's true that cutting off the gas would be more disruptive to the EU's economy than cutting off Russian oil, partly because of the way that these materials physically get here. Like, it's easier to buy oil from someone else than gas, because the gas comes through these pipelines.
Mm.
So when I first saw these headlines about an oil embargo, I was like, you know, maybe this is just a case of the EU suggesting some sanctions that are kind of easy, low-hanging fruit. But this is actually a really big deal. Russia makes a lot more money out of selling oil to Europe than it does selling gas. I saw this analysis from the Rhodium Group, they're a research institute. They estimated that oil exports to Europe alone accounted for 11% of Russia's GDP last year.
Wow.
Which is way more than the gas exports, which were less than 3%. So this is a lot of money that the EU would no longer be sending to fund the war. We're talking tens of billions of dollars.
So the plan isn't just to cut off all the oil that comes from Russia into the EU overnight, is it?
Yeah. So first of all, this is just stage one. At the time of recording, this is just a proposal from the European Commission, and the member states still need to debate it. But yeah, the plan isn't to just go cold turkey and stop importing Russian oil tomorrow. It would be to phase it out within the next 6 months. There's been quite a lot of concern over what would happen to the global economy if the EU just stopped buying Russian oil overnight.
Mm.
Russia is one of the biggest producers of oil in the world, and the EU is its biggest customer. So if this just happened, you know, like that, it could potentially cause major disruption in the global energy market. And certainly here in Europe, you might expect to see fuel prices shooting up, and that would have a knock-on effect to the prices of pretty much everything, because if fuel prices go up, companies generally pass on those extra costs to consumers. So we'd be looking at really bad sudden inflation. So the plan is instead to do a gradual fade out, which sounds underwhelming, and it means that we would be continuing to send hundreds of millions of euros to Russia every day for maybe 6 months. That is money that can be spent on guns and bombs. Now, we could spend this entire podcast debating the extent to which countries should be bringing in really drastic sanctions that could blow up the Russian economy instantly, or whether it's counterproductive to bring in sanctions that create situations where ordinary people on low incomes in, like, you know, Spain or Germany literally can't pay their bills. So I won't dwell on that argument for too long, apart from to tell you that this debate is still very much something that the EU is wrestling with. And you can see that in the fact that this oil embargo is going to apply less strictly to Hungary and Slovakia. Those two countries are very, very dependent on Russian oil. And Hungary especially has basically spent this entire week protesting about how difficult it would be for them to find alternative supplies.
Question.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't Russia just sell all of this oil then just to someone else and they would be funding the bombs and guns?
Maybe. So the most obvious buyers are India and China. And if Russia isn't able to sell all of this oil to the EU anymore, they could offer it at a discounted price to those countries. India has already been buying more oil from Russia in recent weeks at knockdown prices. But there's logistical reasons why India can't import that much more from Russia than it is already. And China might buy some of this oil, but it actually needs less oil than it usually does right now because of their really intense COVID policy, which has shut down large parts of the Chinese economy. So even if Russia do find buyers for some of the oil, you can still expect the EU ban to hit the Russian economy in quite a brutal way.
Another question. How likely is it that the EU will replace this oil with better, greener, more renewable forms of energy?
Well, short term, it does look like the focus is on trying to figure out where the EU can buy fossil fuels if it's not from Russia, which I know isn't what you want to hear. And I don't want to cut the EU too much slack about it, but it would be really difficult to transition to using 100% renewable energy literally overnight. You need to build, you know, wind farms and solar farms, and that stuff takes time.
Makes sense.
It does make sense.
I'll let them off. No, I won't let them off the hook.
Not too much. If you look at Germany, for example, that country has really been under pressure to reduce its dependence on Russian energy because Germany has really been seen as enabling Putin for years and years because of this all-important energy relationship. And Germany has weaned itself off quite a lot already. It now only gets 35% of its gas from Russia, as opposed to 55% just before the war. But it's still buying plenty of gas and oil right now. It's just from other suppliers. If you look at the EU as a whole and on the more long term, there is this new EU energy strategy that's been announced since the start of the war, the snappily named Repower EU policy. And under that plan, we are supposed to be slashing our need for Russian gas imports by 2/3 by the end of the year. And we're supposed to be completely independent from all Russian fossil fuels by 2030, absolute latest. And all of this anyway comes as the EU is supposed to be weaning itself off fossil fuels in general under its Fit for 55 climate plan that we talked about a while back. So we should stop buying fossil fuels from Russia eventually. But there was a good analysis by the Atlantic Council that looked at how we're actually going to make ourselves less dependent on Russian gas in the immediate term. And ultimately, these clever researchers predicted that we will probably not be able to cut our use of Russian gas this year by as much as the EU says it wants to. It just isn't doable. But, you know, having said that, we're already in a situation where Russia has cut off the gas to Poland and Bulgaria because they won't pay for it in rubles. And it's still really up in the air where that particular situation is going. So who knows whether it will be the EU deciding to kick its Russian gas habit or Russia making that decision for us. As for the oil embargo, the big development of the week, as so often in Europe, you know, getting all of our squabbling countries to agree on anything feels almost miraculous. So I guess we should celebrate that this is even looking likely right now. But just to finish, I wanted to give you a reminder of how messed up the situation is. And I wanted to show you this online tracker that updates in real time just how much money the EU has given Russia for energy since the beginning of the war. It's run by the Center for Research and Energy on Clean Air in Helsinki. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I'm going to send it to you, Dominic, right now so that you can take a look. Here you go.
Oh, wow. That's really grim. It's rising so fast.
So at the time of recording, 48 billion.
Since February 24th.
Just since February. I realised this was supposed to be good week. I feel like I failed you.
Good week doesn't have to be happy, Katie. We've got the happy ending for that.
That's true.
And the whole interview about Eurovision to cheer everyone up.
Is Bad Week going to cheer us up? Probably not. But tell us what's going on anyway. Who's had a bad week?
Probably not, no. Because it's been a bad week for relations between Germany and Italy after Germany announced that they were taking Italy to the highest court of the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, over Italian civilian requests for World War II reparations.
Are there still quite a lot of Italians requesting reparations for like World War II era crimes from Germany, like in 2022?
Yeah, I also found that quite extraordinary. But yeah, in the past 10 years, there have been more than 25 Italians going to court in Italy to ask for reparations from Germany. And in many of these cases, the Italian courts ruled that Germany should indeed be paying reparations to the individuals involved.
Interesting. But Germany, I'm assuming, given that this is Bad Week, they're saying that they shouldn't have to pay, right?
Well, yes, they think they shouldn't have to. And the International Court of Justice actually already ruled on this matter back in 2012. They ruled that Italian courts cannot ask Germany to pay reparations to individuals. Mm. This was seen as violating Germany's sovereignty. That case came from 2012, and it was after Italy's Supreme Court had ruled that an Italian man was owed reparations by Germany. He'd been deported by the Nazis in 1944 to Germany and forced to work in a munitions factory. The International Court of Justice ruled in Germany's favour in that case, and as the highest international court out there, Germany believe they can assert legal immunity in the cases that have followed.
Isn't it a bit gross that Germany is saying they shouldn't have to pay reparations to a guy that was literally an enslaved worker?
Yeah, it's pretty gruesome stuff.
So what's their argument? Why are they saying they shouldn't have to pay reparations to this guy?
Well, the German argument is that the case is long closed and the country has already paid out billions since World War II as part of agreements and treaties that were meant to compensate for the atrocities that Germany committed during the war.
Okay, so why are the Italian courts still giving out these kind of rulings if the International Court of Justice says that they shouldn't be doing it anymore?
Well, what happened after that ruling is that the Italian parliament passed a law in line with the ICJ's ruling. But then the Italian Constitutional Court declared parliament's law unconstitutional. So that's how we ended up with the courts continuing to rule in certain cases that Germany owed reparations to some victims, as Germany's immunity was lifted according to the Italian court, even if it was not the case according to the international court. Does that make sense?
Simple. Very simple. Oh, man. I'm glad that I'm not a lawyer. This sounds very complicated. It's given me a headache.
Yeah, oh, it's given me a headache reading about it.
But is there something urgent about it? Like, why is Germany taking this to court right now?
Well, yeah, there is some urgency right now for Germany because in a few weeks, an Italian court is going to rule on whether Italy can forcibly sell some properties in Rome that are owned by the German state as a means of collecting the money that the Italian courts have ruled is owed to certain victims of the Nazis. The Italian court ruling is due to take place on the 25th of May, and it relates to a handful of buildings in Rome, including those that house the Goethe Institute, the German Archaeological Institute, and the German Historical Institute.
Oh, so they do kind of need to get a swift ruling on this. It's if there's a deadline of the 25th.
Yeah, and that's actually quite an ask, considering that the International Court of Justice usually takes years, not weeks, to hold hearings and offer rulings. So we'll have to see if that's possible. This is, of course, not the only debate around German reparations. The Polish government have been trying to secure reparations from Germany in recent years. It's also been a big political item in Greece. Mm-hmm. This is probably a bigger topic than can be discussed in this segment right now. But the bottom line is Germany really does not want to reopen this debate, neither on the countrywide level nor with these civil cases in Italy. So we'll just have to see if the ICJ will rule in line with their earlier ruling and protect Germany from potentially having to have state property in Italy sold off against their wish.
I've been kind of wondering how to fill my time now that the French presidential election is over. And I finally thought of a thing, Dominic, and that is sending voice messages to all of the kind people who signed up to support this podcast with $5 a month. We've got quite a backlog of these mini little personalized podcasts to record for our supporters.
Oh yeah, we should do that. Oh, but you're getting married this week. Should we do it next week?
We'll do it. That'll be my honeymoon. If you would like to receive one of these messages, and people do really, really like them, you can give us a massive helping hand in signing up to support us with €5 or dollars or some other kind of currency a month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. But we really do appreciate all donations, big and small, so that we can pay our producers and keep the show running.
We have two new wonderful patrons to thank this week. Their names are Lena Cherfas and Erica Said. If you've got even a very small amount of spare cash rattling around in your pocket each month, then why not throw it at us?
Ow. It goes without saying that we take Eurovision extremely seriously on this podcast. Ever since that fateful year that Dominic and I first watched it together in a gay bar in Amsterdam, we have been hooked on the kitschness and camp and general amazingness of this ridiculous pop music competition. And we will, of course, be glued to the screen for the finals on May the 14th. But listeners, I just wanted to give you a glimpse into just how seriously Dominic took the interview that you're about to hear. So quite often we cover like quite newsy topics in our interviews. But nevertheless, I'd say it's normally me who's more worried about the things that our guests say getting out of date, probably because of my background as a news journalist. But with this interview, Dominic told me in all seriousness that we couldn't record it too early because Eurovision news moves so fast. And it's very, very important that we give people the latest up-to-date Eurovision developments.
It's so true.
It's a fast-moving situation.
Are you not on Eurovision Twitter?
Not so much yet. I'm going to get into it this week. Anyway, in the end, the delightful conversation that you're about to hear looks a bit more to the past than the future, because we're going to hear about the history of Eurovision from the historian with maybe the coolest job on the continent. Dean Vuletic is a historian of contemporary Europe at the University of Vienna. He is the author of the first ever scholarly book about Eurovision. It's called Postwar Europe and the Eurovision Song Contest. And it tries to assess the contest's role in Europe's identity and its politics from an academic perspective. Dean had to analyse every single song ever entered into the competition, more than 1,500 songs at the time. And it's pretty difficult to find anyone in the world who speaks more authoritatively about this competition that we absolutely love. So we were delighted to speak to Dean Vuletic in Vienna just before he heads to Turin for the big night.
You've made a career as an academic authority on the history of the Eurovision Song Contest, which seems like a truly excellent career choice. I'm a bit jealous. And I assume you are a Eurovision fan as well as a Eurovision professional, in which case, when did your love of Eurovision begin?
Well, I actually grew up in Australia, and I grew up in a Croatian family in a very multicultural neighborhood. There were a lot of Southern European migrants, especially from Croatia, Italy, and Portugal. So we always had European music around us. And there was a multilingual broadcaster established in Australia in the early 1980s called the Special Broadcasting Service, or SBS, which targeted non-English-speaking background migrant communities in Australia. And from 1983, SBS started showing Eurovision. So I was growing up in Perth, dreaming about traveling to faraway lands. I was really interested in languages. I spoke Croatian and English at home, studied Italian. So Eurovision seemed to encapsulate all of these interests and dreams and this wanderlust.
And so turning to the professional side of things and your research in the history of Eurovision, where did the idea for Eurovision come from? Like, who do we have to thank for this delightful celebration of weirdness that we get to enjoy every year?
Eurovision was based on the Sanremo Italian Song Festival. And in the mid-1950s, the European Broadcasting Union decided that it wanted to pursue cooperation in the production of television programs in order to test this nascent technology of television and to experiment with it to see if it could broadcast simultaneously and live across Western European states a common television show. And the first experiments were held in 1954, and they were basically focused on the World Cup that was then taking place in Switzerland. Then RAI, the Italian National Broadcasting Organization, suggested that the European Broadcasting Union develop a program based on the model of the Sanremo International Song Festival. And so it was decided in 1955 at a meeting in Rome that the European Broadcasting Union would set up the Eurovision Song Contest.
It's gone on to be a huge success since then, and it's changed enormously since its original occurrence. But I think one of the reasons why it's so successful is because there are so few moments in our lives as Europeans when we feel like we share a cultural space. Mm-hmm. Eurovision is really that only moment in the year where, well, at least for a queer person who doesn't watch football or sports, where I really feel connected culturally to my fellow Europeans in that way. Do you think Eurovision is a force for good on this continent?
Well, Dominic, you're exactly right that there are few other events that unite Europeans as much as Eurovision does. And you're exactly right once again that perhaps the other events that do are football ones. Is Eurovision a force for good? Well, certainly the fact that it brings 200 million Europeans every year around their television screens to participate in a common cultural moment. Certainly that is a major positive impact that Eurovision has had. The fact that it has introduced people to different languages, to different musical styles, to different social issues is another very positive characteristic I would attribute to Eurovision. But there is also another side to the contest, and that side includes the participation of national broadcasting organizations controlled by authoritarian regimes. It includes the commercialization of the contest, which has sometimes meant that Eurovision had to compromise the public service aims of the European Broadcasting Union. I think these days it also includes the neglect of linguistic diversity. So we don't see the wealth of Europe's languages in Eurovision anymore, ever since 1999, when the rules were changed to allow for entries to be sung in any language and not just their national languages.
On that point, I'm always surprised that they don't subtitle songs into the local language. Like if I watch it in the Netherlands, it would be really good to have all the words translated into Dutch. Is there any move to do that?
No, there hasn't been in the past, though there have been translations done by some of the national broadcasters. Commentators have also been given the responsibility to explain the lyrics to viewers, national commentators. These days, I mean, it's easy. You just look up the song on the internet and you can find translations.
So it's supposed to be an event that leaves politics behind us and unites us with pop music. But Eurovision is really political, isn't it? Like, it feels like every year there's a controversy over, I don't know, like a country trying to send a geopolitical message with their song, or certain countries maybe voting for each other. Has it always been like that?
It has always been like that. I mean, it has always been presented by the European Broadcasting Union as a non-political event, but politics has always played as a backdrop to the contest. And of course, this is going to be the case when you have countries, states participating against each other. International relations are going to come into play, and international relations are political. So, for example, I can say that in the first contest in 1956, West Germany made a very obvious political statement when it sent, as its first representative ever in Eurovision, a Jew and a Holocaust survivor, Walter Andreas Schwarz, to sing for it in the contest.
The European Broadcasting Union regularly tweaks the rules of Eurovision to try and make it as fair as possible. And the most recent big change was in 2016 when they brought in jury voting to make up 50% of the votes, with the televoting as the other 50% from the public. Do you think this change in the voting rules has helped make the competition more fair, and has it created more of an equal playing field and made regional voting less likely?
I don't think that it has made regional voting or block voting less likely. This change was introduced in 2009. So for the preceding decade, there had been 100% public voting. And there was a lot of complaining done by West European national broadcasters that this was leading to a lot of block voting in East European countries, especially in the Balkans and the former Soviet Union. First of all, though, this block voting was never decisive in determining the winner of Eurovision. It had an impact on perhaps countries ranking somewhere in the middle of the scoreboard. But this paranoia about East Europeans somehow conniving together to try and dominate the contest really stems from anxieties around the expansion of the European Union. It didn't have so much to do with actual voting or what scientific research tells us about the impact of this voting. So I think that this change hasn't really made things fairer, because I think they were still quite fair beforehand. Even if we look at that decade, there were wins by Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Greece, Finland. And then, let's say from East Europe, Serbia, Russia, Latvia, Estonia, and Ukraine. So it's about 5 and 5. But I think the problem is that you don't see any of the big West European countries like Spain, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, you know, having won. And then it also tended to be their national broadcasters, which were more critical of the voting.
I love how Western European paranoia over migration manages to find its way into everything, including Eurovision.
Exactly. But on the other hand, you know, migration has always been reflected in Eurovision, let's say, in the sort of artists who are representing states. So when or national broadcasters want to present their countries as being more open, tolerant, cosmopolitan, then they'll often send migrants or even singers who are not citizens as their representatives. So this was already done, let's say, in the early 1960s by Austria when it sent an Israeli singer to represent it. Migration has actually always been reflected in Eurovision. I also suppose because the popular music industry is a cosmopolitan construct. You know, it's about trade, it's about export, the sharing of different cultural influences, the search for markets. It goes along with Eurovision as well.
I wanted to ask you, actually, for musicians, one of the things about performing at Eurovision is that it introduces you to this huge audience that might never otherwise have heard of you. Are there acts who owe basically their entire success to this competition?
I would say that there are a few acts that have managed to really use their participation in Eurovision to forge international careers. So the big names that have come out of Eurovision are Domenico Modugno, whose song Volare was performed in Eurovision in 1958 and which went on to become the world's biggest ever non-English language popular music hit. Then we have ABBA. ABBA won Eurovision in 1974 with Waterloo. Julio Iglesias from the early 1970s. Celine Dion wins Eurovision for Switzerland in 1988, and that really is a springboard for her international career. Since then, I would say the other biggest group to come out of Eurovision was Maneskin last year in 2021, and they really hit the international charts. So there haven't really been that many artists. Paradoxically, the success that artists tend to achieve by performing in Eurovision tends to remain national or regional. Or let's say, I know from my experiences in the Balkans that a lot of artists see their performance in Eurovision there not as a way to access a huge European market, but as a way to make a name for themselves in the Balkan regional market, which does have its own popular music industry that transcends the borders between countries.
When did Eurovision start to have such a strong following amongst people in the LGBTQ plus community? Is that a more recent phenomenon?
Some would argue that that phenomenon goes back to the early 1960s when the French singer Jean-Claude Pascal won Eurovision with the song Nous les Amoureux, We the Lovers. When you read the lyrics of this song, he doesn't mention the gender of the lovers, and it appears as if it really could be a song also about same-sex love. And after that, it became quite a staple of gay culture. Let's say in gay bars, you could watch Eurovision. In the 1980s, we start seeing the first drag acts, the first queer acts. Even though the European Broadcasting Union was not comfortable with this until the late 1980s, because, you know, this was still a social taboo in European states until then. And there we really see a change in 1998 when Dana International wins for Israel. But some have suggested that this was basically due to the success of gay block voting across Europe. But whatever it was, I mean, it was an excellent song and it also had a strong message. And Dana International really opened the world up to the fact that Eurovision is an event with a big queer following.
Before we let you go, I have to ask you quickly about this year's competition. Who have you got your eye on this year? Who's interesting?
There really are several interesting entries in the contest this year. Of course, Ukraine is favored by the bookies to win. I don't quite think that that will happen. I think there will be a lot of support for Ukraine, but sympathy votes have never decided the winner of the contest. If we look back to 1993, when Bosnia and Herzegovina and Croatia debuted and both submitted entries which were about the wars in these countries, they also did not win Eurovision then. We have this duo, Mahmoud and Blanco from Italy, singing a love song, which is actually the first time a male duo in Eurovision sing a song about their love. We have the Serbian singer Konstrakta obsessively washing her hands on stage, alluding to the COVID-19 pandemic, and a Latvian song, Eat Your Salad, a group of men who sing about living a green life, but are full of sexual references. It's actually very, very funny, I think. But there is one ballad which I think is absolutely beautiful, and it's the Swiss entry called Boys Do Cry. It's about boys and men being able to feel and have emotions. It's a very simple ballad, but the wow factor is this singer's voice. He has this raspy voice that reminds you of Louis Armstrong. And it's going to depend on how the song is performed on stage. Simplicity and emotion can also make a winner in Eurovision. So I think that this could also be somewhat of a dark horse.
All of this talk of Eurovision has brought back just how much fun we had last year when one of our listeners helped to set up a Eurovision sweepstake for our Patreon supporters so that we could all try and guess how many points all the countries are going to get. Do you remember?
Oh, that was great.
What do you say that we do it again this year?
I think that's a great idea. Let's do it.
We will get that set up as a little extra incentive for people to sign up to support the podcast over the next week. You will find all the details coming this week on patreon.com/Europeans Podcast. I'm guessing you've been making your way through all the Eurovision entries, but what else have you been enjoying this week?
Yeah, that's been keeping me pretty busy, but I'm also halfway through a new book by the Glaswegian writer Douglas Stewart. It's called Young Mungo, and it's the second novel after his first, which was called Shuggy Bane, won the prestigious Booker Prize in 2020.
Oh, yeah. That one's supposed to be quite a hard read, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And in a way, this is also kind of a hard read. It's quite dark and violent, the world that he's depicting. But it's also really touching and a bit romantic. It gives a really vivid depiction of this 15-year-old boy called Mungo who's growing up in a tenement in Glasgow in the 1990s, a world which Stewart, the writer, knows very well himself. He was a gay child growing up in an estate in Glasgow with an alcoholic single mother who died when he was 16. And his life story actually is extraordinary. He hadn't read a novel until he was 17. He didn't have any formal training in writing or literature, and his first novel was rejected, I think, over 40 times by publishers. Now he is writing such compelling novels, so I really recommend you check this one out. I have to admit, I'm actually listening to it, not reading it. But I really highly recommend the audio version because my crappy Glaswegian accent in my head would have been way worse than the beautiful Glaswegian accent of the man reading the book.
Oh, I'm going to get that next on my audiobook subscription. Thanks for the tip.
It's also got an amazing book cover photograph of two men kissing, which I found so striking that I looked into it and turned out it's taken by my favorite German photographer, Wolfgang Tillmans, who actually, here's a second bit of isolation inspiration. You should follow him on Instagram. He posts really beautiful images, obviously, because he's an amazing photographer. But he also posts really astute commentary about European politics. So I'm sure his account would be enjoyed by a lot of our listeners. His Insta handle is @Wolfgang_Tillmans.
Nice.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
Well, I have been racing my way through season 2 of Russian Doll on Netflix. I think you've started it too, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm on episode 3.
Oh man, it is so much fun. Are you enjoying it so far?
Yeah, I am. I'm not finding it as easy viewing as season 1, but I do think it's really intelligent TV.
I also really loved the first season so much. And it is kind of hard to see how it can get better from that because it's just such a like glorious, weird and wonderful show. But without giving too much away, I think I can tell you that some of season 2 takes place here in Europe. And Natasha Lyonne, the ever watchable star and co-writer of the series, she actually learned Hungarian for her role in season 2. And I'm really interested to hear what Hungarian speakers make of that performance. It's an extremely fun watch and I really wish I could talk more about it, but I am at risk of dropping huge spoilers, including for you, only on episode 3. So I will simply be quiet.
I've got another energy happy ending for you this week, as there was a new wind farm that opened just off the coast of the harbour city of Taranto, a city that sits on the inner bit of the heel of Italy's boot, if that makes sense.
I know the bit you're talking about.
Yeah, you know the bit. And you might be asking me, like, why is another wind farm worth talking about as happy news? Like, are we really that desperate? But it's because this wind farm is the first ever offshore wind farm made in Italy and the first ever wind farm built in the Mediterranean Sea, which I saw as a small ray of hope that things can move forward with our transition away from fossil fuels. This wind farm will provide energy for 21,000 homes, and the same company has plans for a huge wind farm off the coast of Sicily, which they say could provide energy for millions of families. We'll see if that happens.
Wow.
This one's been 14 years in the making, so we'll need them to accelerate the pace if we're going to wean ourselves off fossil fuels fast enough to save this planet. And Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi acknowledged that this week when he said that his government is working to streamline procedures, cut red tape and speed up investments. But for now, a happy, windily energetic ending to this week's episode in southern Italy.
Rolls off the tongue. We will be back next week, fully braced for Eurovision. In the meantime, if you haven't heard last week's episode, Mohammed, do go back and listen to that. We're super proud of how it turned out. And you can also find us on various bits of the internet between episodes. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. Or if you fancy pinging us an email, it's hello@EuropeansPodcast.com.
Remember to join Patreon if you want to be part of our Eurovision sweepstake this year. And we'll be sending more details around about that later this week.
The show is produced this week by me and Wojciech Alexiak, and we are part of the Are We Europe family. You can find other continental flavoured podcasts at the link in the show notes.
Have a good wedding, Katie.
Oh, thanks, and have a good week, everyone else.
Geese.
Stravo.